Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Martin Anderson. I represent Plaintiff and Appellant David Ortega. I wanted to address, I can tell from watching the court today that the court is very familiar with the briefs, and so unless the court wants me to, I'm going to dispense with the usual kind of overview of our argument. There are two issues that I want to talk to the court about today. One is Toyota's Rule 28J letter. Toyota has submitted two unpublished district court decisions on Friday of last week, which it contends support its position. And we disagree that these two district court decisions have any bearing at all on this case, because in those two cases, none of the arguments that are being made in this appeal were made, and therefore none of the arguments were decided by the district courts. In both of those cases, it appears neither party argued that 15 U.S.C. 2308 had any impact on California law. That obviously is a principal issue in this case. In both of those cases, no party even made the argument that a latent defect was sufficient under California law, as far as I can tell. Nothing about any of those cases had any finding by a finder of fact that a defect... should I pause for a moment?
Yes, because I don't have copies of the 28J letter, and so I don't even know what you're talking about. So
I don't feel badly. I don't either.
And you're saying, okay, so you're saying there was a 28J letter filed, and it has two.
Judge Ferguson has it.
Okay, two unpublished memorandum dispositions. Is that what you're saying?
Correct.
So don't worry about it.
Very well.
They're not precedential.
I certainly agree with that. All right.
Worry about this for me. Can you cite to the record any specific evidence that was offered at trial that would allow the jury to conclude that the defect in this car arose either at the time of sale or within 3 months after the sale, and give me a page citation?
I cannot.
If you have one.
I cannot give you a page citation. I can tell you that in our brief we gave a summary of the evidence. I think that the jury...
But the summary of the evidence would have to necessarily rely on something that actually happened at the trial. Do you have in your summary some citation to the record?
We have... One moment. What we have is a citation to the record in our brief, and I have my brief in front of us, discussing the facts that were introduced as evidence. There was introduced... And I don't think even the facts are disputed. The facts are... The plaintiff bought the vehicle.
Now, try my question. Cite me something, if you have, that would allow a jury to infer or find that the defect was present at the time of sale or within 3 months after the sale.
Well, at the excerpts of record 189.18, Mr. Ortega testified that he didn't do anything to the vehicle. That would allow a jury to infer that the defect existed at the time of sale because he didn't do anything out of the ordinary to it. There was also no evidence that the vehicle was in an accident. I believe, really, the issue here is a negative. There's no evidence that there was anything other than a defect that could have caused this. And so you're asking me to say, in a sense, it's the entire record. The entire record shows that this vehicle was not subject to anything other than ordinary use. And the very definition of a defect is a product that fails in ordinary use.
In this case, it failed 9 months later.
The failure became evident 9 months later.
Do you have any evidence of a latent defect that did not manifest itself until 9 months later, either by expert or lay opinion?
The evidence is the failure 9 months later. Had the vehicle not failed 9 months later, there would be no evidence. But it did.
What about this expert? I actually have the exact same question. It's Judge Zawari, and so I asked my law clerk to go through the record, and your expert testified that the engine under normal circumstances should not have blown even if Ortega had not changed the oil until after he had driven it for 7,900 miles, stating no car should have an engine fail in 7,000 miles.
Certainly our expert said that, and I think that's something that we could all take, the court could take judicial notice of that. Everyone knows that when you buy,
I don't know anything about cars, so don't tell me everyone knows.
Well,
just tell me what's in the record.
I apologize. Yes, that is in the record, and that's certainly one of the points that supports the jury's inference. But it's not the only point.
Well, what about, I guess I'm trying to struggle with this, because the jury instruction on merchantability. No one objected to it, and it had to do, it said at the time of the sale that it was not fit for ordinary use. So the jury, we have to find, see if there's any rational basis for the jury having concluded that. And I guess that's the fundamental question. Is there any rational basis? And, I guess one of the bases, was there evidence that the engine had failed previously before it was sold to Mr. Ortega?
No, there was no evidence in the record of the condition of the vehicle prior to the sale.
So what evidence is there about the condition at the time of sale?
The evidence was that the vehicle was purchased, that it was driven off the lot, and that it did not that it was used normally for a period of 7,000 miles, 9 months, and then it had a failure.
Was there any testimony about the nature of this kind of failure, that it, you know, that it was had to have been present at the time of sale, or that wasn't really an issue in your case, was it?
I don't know how to answer that question. I think that the certainly the evidence allowed a jury to infer that this, that when this vehicle left, it had some manner of defect in it, which progressed as time passed until the vehicle finally failed. It would be, I think, implausible to argue that this vehicle was 100% defect-free until 7 months later, when all of a sudden it just changed and became non-defective. The inference that the jury is allowed to draw, and that the jury did draw, is that under ordinary normal use, which they found ordinary normal use, because if they had found abuse, they would have ruled for Toyota. There was a jury instruction directly on point. The inference is that an automobile used properly and maintained properly will not have a major engine failure in 7,000 miles or 9 months. And I think that's borne out by the ordinary experience of jurors. It's something that I hesitate to say everyone knows, because Judge Wardlaw, you've already said no. But I think the ordinary common experience is that new vehicles should not fail, and in the absence of a defect, do not fail in 7,000 miles in this way.
And that's all that you needed to show?
That is all that the plaintiff needed to show to prevail. That's correct. That the vehicle was either unfit for its... Well, that's assuming that the standard is at the time of sale. Obviously, we don't contend that's the standard that we had to show at all. That under the law, under the applicable law, the standard was, did the vehicle have an unfitness for it or its ordinary purpose? Did it not pass without objection in the trade during the period of the express warranty? That, in our view, is the proper legal standard. It's the proper determination. And under that test, even Toyota admits that the plaintiff is entitled to judgment. The only point that Toyota made in its motion for judgment as a matter of law was that the implied warranty period was less than 3 years, that it was, in fact, only, I believe, 3 months. And I don't think that we even need to reach that issue, because the jury found something else, and they never challenged that in the district court. There was no claim made in the district court by Toyota that the jury's verdict wasn't supported by the evidence. The claim was simply that this legal issue, which was irrelevant to the jury's consideration, should be resolved in their favor.
Well, may not have been irrelevant, but it wasn't presented to the jury. Jury instructions did not go to the point.
Correct. And that's what I mean. It was irrelevant to the jurors. The jurors were not back in the jury room saying, gosh, if it's only 3 months, the plaintiff loses. If it's 3 years, the plaintiff wins. They were in the jury room saying, based upon all the evidence that was presented at trial, Toyota's theory, the plaintiff's theory, the use of the vehicle, the history of failures after the initial failure, we believe. And by the way, that's another point that I want to make, is the time of the first failure by itself, I don't know whether that would have been sufficient to convince a jury that the defect existed at the time of sale. But when you look at the repair history in total, you look at the vehicle coming back again and again and again, and the dealer's inability to find out what the root cause is. Because we know that they...
Well, isn't it just as likely that the root cause occurred 9 months later?
No.
And then the repeated failures afterwards?
No. It isn't. It isn't likely because there's no evidence that something changed in that vehicle 9 months later. There's no evidence, and I think it's Toyota's burden at this point.
How do we know that something didn't change in the first month, the second month, the ninth month? What do you point to that says it had to be when it was sold?
Because when a thing is made, if it does not change, if there's no reason for it to change, then we can infer that it did not. If what you're asking me is, well, maybe something changed about this vehicle through normal use that caused it to fail, my answer to you is that whatever it is that made that change was a defect. Because an automobile, if made properly, should last for at least 9 months and at least 7,000 miles. So if there was, let's take a hypothetical. Let's say that the vehicle's getting in the normal heat ranges. It's warming up and it's cooling down and it's warming up and it's cooling down. And finally, on the ninth month, some part shifts 2 millimeters to the left or to the right. All right? I would argue to you that the defect was in the composition of that material. It should not have shifted.
So you're necessarily arguing that this verdict is supported by a latent defect. Yes?
I am arguing that Toyota did not even raise this issue in the district court, and so they waived it. They did not
argue. Well, they raised it by a motion for a directed verdict, which was addressed by the judge.
No, they argued that the length of the implied warranty of merchantability was 3 months instead of 3 years. They did not argue. They made no argument that there was not sufficient evidence to support the verdict the jury actually reached, which was that the defect existed at the time of sale. They simply did not address that issue. They did not make that point.
They did not make that argument to District Court Judge Sabra?
They did not. The argument they made is that it did not arise during the three-month period, but they did not address the fact that the jury found that it arised at the time of sale.
Well, we don't know what the jury found because they weren't given a question that said, when did this defect take place?
No, what we know is that they answered a question yes, and in order to answer that question yes, they had to have found certain things, and one of them was that at the time of sale, the vehicle was either unfit for its ordinary purpose or it did not conform to the promises of or affirmations of fact on the label or one of the other standards of the implied warranty merchantability. That we know. And again, going back to this issue, if in fact, as a matter of law, the period is 3 years, then even Toyota doesn't dispute that plaintiff was entitled to judgment.
But if it is a matter of law, it's 3 months. Toyota says it is entitled to judgment as a matter of law.
It says that it is, but it made no argument in the district court
to
why.
It did to the district judge who said, quote, plaintiff does not dispute that he did not experience any defects during this warranty period, the three-month period, but asserts, quote, inside the quote, given the evidence, the jury was entitled to infer the vehicle was defective when it was sold. However, plaintiff fails to cite any evidence to support that inference.
And that's where the judge went wrong, because it wasn't our burden to disprove their motion for a judgment as a matter of law.
No, you had a burden to present a prima facie case that would allow your case to go to the jury, and the judge basically said, oops, shouldn't have gone.
No. This was a motion for judgment as a matter of law after trial when the plaintiff had prevailed. There was a presumption that we won. It was Toyota's burden to disprove our case, and they did not do so. Toyota was asking the judge to disregard the findings of the jury.
No, they raised the motion after the plaintiff's case, and the judge denied the motion but said, you know, I'm not sure, let's go, and if there's an adverse verdict, come back and talk to me and I'll reconsider it. So they raised it at the stage where they were arguing you did not present a prima facie case.
I agree. And
renewed the motion after the verdict.
I agree, that, and there it would have been our burden to point the judge to evidence in the record to support the view that we could go forward. Absolutely. But once the jury found in our favor, I think the burden shifted to Toyota to prove that the judgment was...
What's your legal authority that the burden of proof shifts after the verdict? I'm unfamiliar with that. And maybe there is such authority. I'm unaware of any shifting. Your burden is to present the prima facie case.
One moment.
And what the district judge is saying, that the verdict is not supported by sufficient evidence.
Let me investigate that issue while defendant's counsel is addressing it. May I address that in rebuttal?
Sure.
All right.
I don't mean to monopolize. My colleagues may have questions.
No, there's a standard. There's a standard for a judgment as a matter of law. And it's that judgment as a matter of law is proper if the evidence construed in the light most favorable to the non-moving party permits only one reasonable conclusion, and that conclusion is contrary to the jury's. So we have to construe the evidence in the light most favorable to Ortega and determine whether it permits only one reasonable conclusion contrary to that found by the jury. And that's our standard.
And that is where I infer this burden, because Toyota is coming forward saying this verdict is wrong.
Well, that's why I'm asking you, let's construe this evidence in the light most favorable to Ortega, and what is it that supports a verdict? The problem with this case, the real problem, is that the three-month limitation on the duration of the warranty was not part of the trial. The jury was not instructed on it. So I can't say that the jury, in fact, found that the defect was outside the time period, because it was never asked.
I believe if you look at the instructions, what they were asked is, did the defect occur at the time of sale? I believe that is the only way they could have found in plaintiff's favor. By the way, I agree with the general proposition. I wish the instructions had included the duration, and in fact, we did submit instructions that included a durational element. The district judge, Judge Sabraw, chose to use his own instructions. He in fact omitted several of the claims that were asserted in the complaint, and there's a level of frustration for me there. But what we do have for sure is a jury finding that at the time of sale, the vehicle was either unfit for its ordinary purposes or did not pass without objection in the trade under the contract description. What we also have is that Toyota admits that if the durational period is 36 months, that this vehicle met the standard. I don't think there's anyone that disputes that. The question of the first 3 months is obviously only one issue, but looking at the evidence in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, looking at the fact that it was sold as a new product, it was sold as a new vehicle, it was driven, it was not abused, it was driven as any other automobile should be driven. That's what the jury necessarily found when they ruled in the plaintiff's favor. And then it had a series of failures that the dealer could never remedy. The dealer was able to remedy the catastrophic nature of the failure, but never to stop whatever it was that was causing it to fail again. A reasonable inference that the jury could have drawn, and indeed did draw, is that the defect existed at the time of sale. Taking the evidence in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, as we must, that is a reasonable inference. Because Toyota has not demonstrated any reason not to draw that inference, and again, this is where I get to, it's Toyota's burden. They're asking the district judge, and now in essence asking you, to say, look, there was simply no evidence to support this verdict. Well, there was. There was a reasonable inference which the jury drew, which any reasonable person could draw. And in fact, we cite two cases where courts of appeal affirmed judgments in very similar situations. One of them, I think, was the, I want to say no ice. I don't know how to pronounce it, but the NOICE case where it was in 8 months. And I think there was another case called Vernon. So it's not unprecedented to make that inference. It's not unreasonable to make that inference. And I would go one step further. We're not just talking about any car. We're talking about Toyota. And setting aside some recent adverse publicity,
they got some good publicity recently.
Toyota is a quiet car. So you try to emulate that. I mean, you say your threshold of frustration, you reach it easily. So you gotta think about raising that threshold. Because I'm trying to escape the high decibel level, and sometimes I can miss some of the golden statements that you're making.
Toyota is well known for making high quality cars. There is no circumstance under which a Toyota should have a major engine failure after 7 months. It just shouldn't happen. And if it does, it's reasonable to infer that it happened because they made the car wrong. They had a material failure somewhere. There's a part that's not in the parts that failed that is causing the failure. Obviously, we don't know what it is that caused the failure, but again, that's not our burden. We cite two cases in our reply brief that explain. It's not our burden to explain what's wrong with the car. And in fact, there's ample case law under California law, again, cited in our reply brief, that says that the jury may infer the existence of a defect from repeated failures. There's another case that I don't think we cited, Suman versus BMW of North America, where a vehicle was in repeat.
No one's questioning the defect.
Right.
The issue is when.
Well, and the issue
but
is how...
we belabored it, so I...
How do you define a defect? Do you define a defect as the vehicle stops working, or do you find a defect as the vehicle has a problem? It has something about it that is not right. Well, if you look at the warranty, it's a defect in materials or workmanship. It's not that it stops working. That's not the standard for a defect. The standard is...
So what if this happened? What if this happened on the 35th month?
All right. What if it happened on the 35th month?
Same thing.
I think we would need... I think I would want more facts. Did it happen on the 35th month and it was repaired and it never occurred again? Or did it happen on the 35th month and then continue again and again and again, as in this case? And in that case, did Toyo have evidence that perhaps there wasn't proper maintenance? Maybe it happened on the 35th month and the consumer never changed the oil in the entire period of ownership. Under those circumstances, a jury might well say, you know what? You don't change the oil in the car. That's something that Toyota is not responsible for. Now, I know we've addressed this issue. I do want to ask, does the court have any questions for me about the preemption issue, about the 2308, about the warranty extension? Because I think these obviously are very important issues to us, and if the court has any questions, I want to answer them.
I guess my question is, why are these two parties not selling this case and quibbling over $28,000 in federal court of appeals?
Well, the answer to that question is, I don't know, right? I mean, ultimately, the decision to settle, the decision to offer money comes from the defendant. I can tell you from my personal experience handling lemon law cases, the Japanese manufacturers have very large egos. They think that they make perfect cars. I've had cases where that was Toyota's argument. We make perfect cars.
Yeah,
we don't.
They're like American lawyers. Where's the car now?
I believe it's still in San Diego. It's in the plaintiff's garage.
Oh, he doesn't drive it anymore?
I don't know the answer to that.
Huh?
I don't know the answer to that.
When was the last time you had visitation with a car?
My office is in Orange County. I co-counseled this case with a lawyer in San Diego. I personally have not seen it.
Oh, okay. So we don't know whether he's driving it or not.
We don't. What we can know is that had the district judge not granted the motion for judgment as a matter of law, he would not have the car, right? Toyota would have it if he would have received it.
And why do we have jurisdiction over this?
The complaint alleges claims under the Federal Magnuson-Moss Warranty Act, which creates federal subject matter jurisdiction. But if that's an issue you're going to visit, I would ask for leave to submit supplemental briefing.
No, I'm just curious. It can't be diversity. The amount of controversy isn't that high. Anyway.
You had more claims, but went to trial only on the one claim.
We went to trial on more than one claim. There were at least two claims that were tried. There was a breach of warranty, express warranty, and a breach of implied warranty claim. The jury.
Under state law?
Yes. Yes.
Well, what was the express of? What was the breach of express warranty?
Well, he brought it in and asked them to fix this engine failure, and they repeatedly failed to fix it. And their express warranty, they, like all manufacturers, gave an express written warranty that said, if there's a defect in materials and workmanship, and I'm glad, Your Honor, you asked that question.
Well, we'll fix it.
We'll fix it.
At no cost to you.
Correct.
And then they Well, did they fix anything?
They did. They repeatedly replaced major engine and transmission components. And by the way, this is more evidence that the defect existed at the time of sale, because their express warranty only covers defects in materials and defects in workmanship. So in order for it to be covered under their express warranty, in order for them to have had an obligation to fix it, they had to have found a defect in a material or in their factory workmanship. And they obviously did because they performed repairs under warranty.
Well, did anybody test those parts that were removed?
There's no evidence in the record as to whether or not they were tested or not. Those parts were removed by a Toyota dealer. They were accessible to Toyota under their dealer agreement, and certainly Toyota could have done that, could have submitted evidence that there was no material failure, there was no defect in workmanship. But the state of the record is that at least three times, and possibly four, they actually performed repairs under the warranty, and the warranty only covers defects in materials and workmanship, which means the defect was there at the date the car was sold. And so again, I say, looking at all the evidence, the jury could have reasonably concluded that this vehicle was defective at the time it was sold.
Okay. All right.
All right. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Good afternoon now, Your Honors. I'm John Taylor.
Don't tell us what the time is. Just go ahead. I'll get in trouble.
Just to clear up, the plaintiff didn't prevail in the express warranty claim because the dealership did fix the vehicle. Ultimately, it's all the problems that have been corrected.
There was no express warranty claim that went to the jury. I show three questions for the jury to answer. Two were implied warranties. One was repurchase or replace. They answered no to the two and yes to the implied warranty of merchantability.
Your Honor, the repurchase, replace, that was an express warranty.
Is an express warranty.
Yeah.
And they answered no to that.
They answered no to that. Justice Wardlaw's question, how do we have jurisdiction under Section 1367C? Because there had been originally federal claims in this case, the judge had discretion to retain the case and try it just on the state claim, which he decided to do. Responding to some of the procedural things that have been said, I'd like to just start out there. It's not correct that the three-month issue was not in this case. It was in this case. Toyota made a 50A motion at the close of plaintiff's case to say no defect arose during the three-month warranty period, implied warranty period. California law requires during that three-month duration that the defect manifests itself. We're entitled to judgment. And the court said, you know, I don't really want to decide that effectively. I don't want to decide that issue of law right now. I'm going to let this go to the jury, and then I'll revisit it afterwards. So,
but isn't why wasn't the jury asked the question? I mean, why didn't Toyota submit an instruction on that? Do you find that the defect was present at the time of the sale, or do you find that, or do you find that it arose? If you find that it arose after the 3 month period, then obviously they check the box that they rule in favor of Toyota. That would be the easiest way to deal with this.
But that issue was not in the case, Your Honor, but it wasn't because we didn't have it in the case. It was because plaintiff injected it after the jury's verdict came back. What we said is California law requires this to come up during the three-month period. There's no dispute that it didn't come up during the three-month period. There was a debate about whether California law requires it.
Well, I'm not sure about that. And again, you know, I'm just an ordinary person when it comes to cars. I have no specialized knowledge. But I don't know that it's so unreasonable to infer from all of these incidences of repairs and oil issues and engine going bad and that it existed from the time that it left the Toyota workmen?
Okay, let's visit that question, Your Honor, because plaintiff is relying on a case called Nexia that did not come out until after the jury's verdict. So this idea that you could rely on a latent defect that existed at the time of sale?
I'm not sure it's a latent defect. I mean, I'm not sure how you're defining latent. I mean, if the car was, the day it was sold, was destined to lose its engine within 7 months, which is the earlier time, according to this evidence, than any other car ever, then it had to be defective at that point in time. Just because it didn't actually lose its engine until another point in time doesn't mean that it wasn't defective at the time it was sold.
But you have to look at the legislative history for this provision. It's section 1795.5. It says there's a three-month duration on implied warranties for used goods. Now, if you look at the history of that legislation, when that was being considered, one of the dealership associations in California wrote to Senator Song, said, we're worried about that provision because we think there ought to be a cutoff when these claims can be asserted. And that duration language, we're not sure that gives us the cutoff. And Senator Song's staff responded by explaining what that language is supposed to mean. And he said, the periods of duration in section 1795.5 are limitations on the time in which a latent defect may surface and create liability for the warrantor. After the expiration of these periods, the warrantor is no longer responsible for those defects existing at the time of sale under the terms of the Act. And that was the explanation, that the defect has to manifest itself during that three-month period, or there's no claim for breach of the implied warranty, even if the argument is, as the plaintiff has said, it existed at the time of sale.
Doesn't mean the plaintiff doesn't have a right of recovery. They can go under an express warranty in the three-year period, which they didn't get in this case.
Now, think of the implications of what plaintiff is saying under this implied warranty theory, which is, if something goes wrong while I own the car, and all I have to do is come into court and say, I never abused the car, I never did anything wrong to it, but now it's broken, and therefore it must be have been defective at the time that it was sold, because that, you know, that's the inference that's created. This court...
So what's wrong with that?
Well, in the Clemens case, this court addressed that and said, every manufactured item is defective at the time of sale in the sense that it won't last forever. And you've got cases like from the Second Circuit in the Abraham case, where the court said, if we have a time-limited warranty, as express warranties and implied warranties are in California, and we create a rule that says you can make a claim based on the warranty, based on this latent defect idea, that would render meaningless the time and mileage limitations and warranties. Just to quote here, virtually, this is from the Abraham case, virtually all product failures discovered in automobiles after expiration of the warranty can be attributed to a latent defect that existed at the time of sale or during the term of the warranty. And therefore, the court said, we're not going to let you circumvent time-limited warranties by saying, oh yes, even though this defect didn't arise until after the warranty expired, the warranty period expired, I think the thing must have been defective from day one, else it wouldn't have gone wrong. That eliminates warranty periods. And since California has imposed a warranty period on implied warranties, it's one of the, according to Mr. Anderson, one of the few states that's done that, that they have said, we're going to make this a three-month warranty period. If you don't create a rule, if you don't acknowledge the legislative history that says this defect has to come out during that three-month period, basically you've created a situation where you have an unlimited warranty period.
So your position is we don't need to reach the issue of whether this is a latent defect or not. It didn't manifest itself within 3 months. It's an implied warranty under California law. No go.
Exactly. That is exactly the point.
And how do you distinguish the Mexia case?
Well, I first have to just say I read Mexia last night, and I'm not totally sure they knew what they were saying in that decision, but it's a pleadings case, and I think it's complicated about how it even applies here. But I think actually
that is an important distinction, is it not?
It is.
It's on the pleadings, not during trial or
right.
Evidence.
And actually it says, even under our rule, which says you don't have to discover the defect within the period, you have to present evidence that, in fact, the defect did exist at the time of sale. But I think in coming up with this latent defect exception, so to speak, to 1795.5, the court just got it wrong. And there hasn't been enough time in California for other appellate decisions to address that same issue, because it's a fairly new case.
What about the Ohio case? Ohio, I'm kind of fond of Ohio. That's your opponent's sites. Can you get around the Noisy case?
I can get around Noisy by saying it didn't ever address a statute like we have in California that has plain language in it. The other thing I would point out, and I know, you know, this court does not give great weight, maybe much precedential value at all to these district court decisions, but the California district courts have been confronted by this issue over and over and over again since Mexia, and they have basically said Mexia is, you know, in their view, not right on California law. It's an outlier. And in these class action decisions, you know, where you've got untimely claims being presented, if you apply the Mexia rule, you're going to never be able to get rid of these claims.
This case isn't a class action, is it?
What's that?
This case isn't.
This is not a class action, but it comes up in class actions at the district court level because people always want to avoid the three-month limitation or for new goods, the one-year limitation, and come in after the fact and say, well, I still have an implied warranty claim, even though it didn't come out during the warranty period. It must have been defective from day one under this latent defect theory. And as far as I can tell, every single California district court that's addressed that argument has said that can't be the law, that can't be right. It would eliminate this three-month limitation in California law.
Is there any evidence in the record that was presented to the jury that showed any type of maintenance on this vehicle from the time it was sold until the nine-month event?
There were no records presented. I think the plaintiff said on the stand that he thinks he changed the oil one time, but he had no records to verify that and did not produce them at trial.
Well, why would he change the oil? Because I think after, 5,000 miles, you go into Toyota and they give you the big service deal free.
That's a BMW. I don't think that.
No, Toyota does it too.
This wasn't a new car. This is a used car, so it's a different deal. Remember that.
And we don't have anything in the record about the condition of the used car when it was purchased by the plaintiff.
No, other than it was a certified vehicle, you know, the dealership had gone through it
and done their regular routine certification. Right.
But for this inference to arise,
is there a difference between the certification of a used car? I mean, why should you treat a used car different from the way you treat a new car?
Well, I don't think that
people go in there, and aren't they told that that we're giving you this warranty and that it's like you're getting a new car?
The new used distinction makes a difference on how long the implied warranty period is. If it had been a new car, it would have been a year long. Here, because it's used, it's only a 3-month period. That's what the legislature has said. And as I said, 1795.5.
How many miles would it have on it?
About 10,000, I think.
10,000? So there was a car that was used. It probably was only driven maybe 2,000 or 3,000 a year.
Not in this case.
It was a used car.
Oh, you mean?
They bought it from Toyota, and it had 10,000 miles on it. It was, it would still be covered by the new car warranty.
Yes, it was, Your Honor.
Yeah.
But again, the car was fixed under the new car warranty, and the jury found there was no breach of that warranty.
Right, and your expert testified that it was Toyota's policy to make repairs under warranty unless it was very clear that the customer alone had caused the problem. So that implies that it wasn't Ortega who caused the problem, Ortega alone.
Well, we don't know that the customer Ortega, we don't know who caused what problem. The thing was that the expert said he could not determine whether this car was defective at the time of sale or not, and that to do that he would have to have examined the parts that were taken out of the car, and that he did not do such an examination. So he conceded he couldn't say whether this vehicle was defective at the time it was sold. And I think for the inference Mr. Anderson would like to apply here, you'd have to have some way of showing that there is no other cause was possible other than defect.
As long as there's a rational basis from which the jury could infer that there was defect, then you would uphold the juror's verdict.
But there wasn't such a basis, because if you could infer a defect simply from the fact that the plaintiff says, I owned the car, I didn't do anything bad to it, and therefore it must be defective from day one, you don't have any warranty periods left at all, because in every case, someone can come forward and say, I've owned this product for 3 years, something failed in it, therefore, it must have been defective when I bought it.
Well, what about the testimony by both experts that this type of failure was extremely rare?
Well, I think that the answer is we don't know what caused this defect. And there, car failures things can go wrong for any number of reasons, and there was not testimony ruling out every single possible cause of this problem besides product defect. That there just wasn't a basis for the jury to infer that in the absence of such evidence, ruling out every other possible cause. Moreover, it would shift the burden of proof to Toyota to prove that the car wasn't defective at the time of sale.
Said the spenny posture. I mean, you probably should have brought this up earlier, maybe at the closing.
We did bring it up.
On summary judgment, because when a case actually goes to the jury and the jury is properly instructed, it's a very high burden to get that jury verdict overturned. Very unusual, very rare. And so at an earlier stage, if this was the law that was going to be applied to this, you would make that motion real early.
Well, Your Honor, the point is that you shouldn't even get to this issue about what whether the jury can infer that there's a defect.
But that's the posture we're at. After a jury trial, that's where we are.
No, because it's undisputed that this defect did not manifest itself during the first 3 months. Their briefs on appeal admit that point.
Well, that's true.
That is the test.
Why wasn't there a summary judgment? No.
The test is whether this...
Maybe you have to change the definition of latent defect.
Under California law, the test for these implied warranties is, did this defect manifest itself during that three-month warranty period? If it didn't manifest itself, even if it existed at the time of sale, it's not a basis for an implied warranty.
Right, but you're not at that position now. You're at a JMOL, and we have to apply the standard of review for a JMOL.
But...
And the standard of review for a JNOL or JNOV... is very similar to the standard of review for a summary judgment.
And the standard of review for the JMOL
is... The record is different, perhaps, but the standard is the same.
Here's the question. The standard at the JMOL stage was, was there any evidence that this defect manifested itself during the three-month period? And the answer to that is absolutely there was none, and even plaintiff doesn't contend that there's evidence that this defect manifested itself during that three-month period.
No, their position is it was latent and it was there, but didn't manifest itself until sometime later.
That's the only way you can get around this three-month rule is to claim that California recognizes some exception to that rule, a latent defect exception, and California law does not. I think Mexia is wrong on that. I think you have the right under the KF Dairies case, which we cited, to look at what the California Supreme Court would do on that issue, and not to follow Mexia if it doesn't state California law. And I think that if you look at, you know, every other case that's looked at Mexia since it was decided has rejected its reasoning and said it is an outlier. It is not consistent with California law. And moreover, the court in that case did not have the benefit of the legislative history materials which we gave this court to look at, which clearly make it patently clear that Senator Song, who was the author of this legislation, intended that three-month period to be a cutoff, even if the defect existed at the time the vehicle was sold. And that very letter, that same letter, has been cited by the California Supreme Court in the Gabaldon versus Daimler Chrysler case as evidencing the legislature's intent. So Mr. Anderson has questioned that letter and said, how do we know that really shows what the legislature intended? Well, we know that because the California Supreme Court has said so in a prior decision, and that is the touchstone for this court to decide whether that letter is relevant.
Can I ask you the question that my colleague asked opposing counsel, and that is, are you interested in a referral to mediation?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because I think this case is important on this issue of this latent defect theory, and that's why both sides have pushed it to this level, because we think that we're absolutely right on that issue. And
So we have Mexia, which is California Court of Appeals.
Right.
And then we have district court cases from the federal courts that question Mexia.
And you have the statutory language and you have the legislature history for that statute, which Mexia...
Do we have any other California state law case that we can follow?
No, because Mexia is too new for anyone to have said that's a crazy result. There are no court of appeal decisions that have come down addressing the issue yet because it's too new. This case only came up in the post-trial motion stage. There was supplemental briefing on it because it was decided at that stage in the case. And I urge you...
But
you know,
are
Your
we Honor, allowed not to apply controlling California authority?
Yes, you are. If you look at the KF Dairies case, in fact, Judge Pragerson was on the panel in that case, there were two intermediate court of appeal decisions that seemed to be controlling, and the Ninth Circuit said, those two intermediate decisions are contrary to general principles of insurance law. We don't think the California Supreme Court would follow those two cases, and we're going to find differently.
Well, maybe we should certify to the California Supreme Court.
I think,
and let it tell us.
I think that's possible.
If it's that important of a legal issue, because it's certainly not worth $28,000 for you guys to be arguing this all the way up to us.
I think that's possible, but I don't think you need to do that, because if you look at, as I said, the plain language of this statute in question and the legislative history for it, you'll see that California law is clear on this. And Mexia just missed some things. No, I don't think the briefing was very good in that case. From what you read in the opinion, you can see the court had some severe criticism.
You know, it's when you can't just criticize this court, you know. It's decision. You can't say, I don't think it was very good. I mean,
well,
you have to give us something else to follow.
You know,
what was that case you just read?
The KF Dairies case, I can give you a side on that. It's 224 F3rd 922.
What was the case about?
It was looking at a question of insurance law, and I don't remember the exact issue, but it looked at two intermediate court appeal decisions.
It wasn't a products liability.
No, it wasn't. But the general point made by the case is this court's job is to figure out what the California Supreme Court would do, not to look at intermediate court of appeal decisions if this court believes they're in error and in conflict with other law. And again, I don't think the Mexican case had.
What do we do there? How long ago was this?
It's a 2000 case.
2000?
2000.
I think about that case every day. read me that quote again.
All right, let me see. This court said, I don't have the full quote here, but it basically said that.
What quote is?
What I have the quote of is the
Who was the author?
You were on the panel. I don't know who the author is. I don't have that in front of me right now.
You don't have a copy of the case?
I don't have a copy of the case.
Well, that's a defect in your workmanship.
Yeah. But the two court of appeal decisions were rejected. Here's the quote. As, quote, in conflict with generally established principles of contract construction as articulated by the California Supreme Court.
Yeah.
So.
Has the California Supreme Court spoken on this?
On 1795.5, no, they have not. But they have specifically approved this letter that Senator Song's staff wrote as evidencing the intent of that particular provision. And that letter makes it clear that what the legislature intended was this was to be a three-month period during which the defect had to manifest itself or it was not going to provide a basis for an implied warranty claim, even if the defect had existed at the time that the product was sold. The letters are attached to our opening brief, Kelly's brief. I urge you to look at them.
What do you mean by manifest itself? The car, vehicle had a breakdown?
Right, the problem has to come out. A breakdown. Something to indicate that the flaw is there during that three-month duration. Otherwise, it's a cutoff. Now, that doesn't mean that.
It's inside the motor someplace, and the quality of the steel or whatever it's made of didn't quite live up to the specifications. No one picked it up, and that happens, and it starts to fatigue, then it finally manifests itself at the end of 9 months because the motor breaks down, you can't drive the car. The argument can be made, there had to be a defect. Otherwise, why would that happen? It's supposed to take the motor apart, look at it.
Yeah, that's the exact scenario that I think that was addressed in the Clemens case, where I think that case, if I'm remembering correctly, involved the manifold on the engine, and it was made of cast iron, and eventually, after the warranty period, it failed, and the claim was.
Well, the Senator Song said it had to manifest itself, will it?
Right.
Maybe it was manifest if you took the engine apart.
But Clemens says, the fact that there's a defect lurking there that's sometimes going to emerge after the warranty period doesn't make it a warranty claim. And that's the same situation here. Everything's going to fail.
Just because Song, who was one of the sponsors, wrote a letter. That doesn't mean that reflects the legislative intent.
Well, he was the author of the legislation.
That doesn't mean anything.
The Supreme Court of California has looked at this very letter in another case and said this evidences the legislature's intent.
Okay, as we've gone this long on this, let me just tell you, I don't think that letter is as clear as applied to this case as you think it is, and I'll let you, I want to be fair and let you respond.
Okay.
The letter says, we recognize that a latent defect may appear only at a later date, that it must tend to show that the defective condition existed at the time of sale. And according to our understanding, the courts have never viewed implied warranties as representing continuing obligations. So a latent defect is you can recover if it shows that the defective condition existed at the time of sale. Tend to show. And then the next paragraph.
Which paragraph were you looking at, Your Honor?
I'm looking at, it's page 2. It's talking about duration or enforcement of implied warranties. And then there's, it's a.
Which, are you looking at the letter from Senator Schlanger or the letter to Senator Schlanger?
Letter to Senator Schlanger.
Okay, I'm talking about the letter from him in response to the letter.
Okay, so then he says, and then, well, that letter also uses traceable to the time of defect. So it's an evidentiary thing, right?
The dealerships were expressing concern about, well, plaintiffs might make these arguments and then they'll be on the hook for a long time. And Senator Song is writing back and saying, don't worry about those arguments. Those aren't any good under this way we've written the statute because it's a 3-month limitation. And it says, after the expiration of these periods, meaning the 3-month period, the warrantor is no longer responsible for those defects existing at the time of sale under the terms of our act. So even if it exists at the time of sale, once those periods have gone past and the defect hasn't manifested itself, there's no claim for a breach of implied warranty. Now, that doesn't take away a remedy from a consumer in most instances because they still have their express warranty claim to make. And that's what happened here. They got the full repair of the vehicle. It was completely fixed.
So where did the Supreme Court cite this letter as?
In the Gavaldon versus Daimler Chrysler case, and that case involves a question about service contracts, and to give you the site, it's 32 Cal 4th, 1246.
I have that one in my book. Thanks.
Okay, 1257 through 1258.
Then he says these are our initial feelings. Okay.
Yeah, with respect to that initial feelings, he later then wrote a letter to the governor when he urged him to sign the bill. The exact same language was still in the statute. And he said, he pointed to that specific provision and he said, this will allow manufacturers to cost their warranty expenses because they'll have a set period under which these problems have to emerge or there's no claim. Now, if you have this latent defect theory, that creates basically indefinite liability for manufacturers on products because you can always come in a year, 2, 3, 4 years after the fact and say, this defect just manifested itself, but it must have been there at the beginning else because I haven't done anything to cause it.
You know, what you're saying makes a whole lot of sense. Yeah. It does. I just don't know what we do about Nexia.
Well, I think you say it's not right.
This has gone on quite a while, and I don't want to try everyone's patience, and I hesitate to do this, but I'd like to follow up my colleague's question to opposing counsel and ask you, in a minute or less, please, why do we have jurisdiction?
Again, when there's a federal claim in the case,
right,
and which got dismissed, and under Section 1367C, the trial judge had discretion to retain it and try it,
right.
Try just the state cases.
Okay.
Is he a new judge?
It's
within the last, wasn't he appointed within the last, not 2 years, but maybe 5, 6 years?
It's possible. I don't know. I'm sorry to say.
Well, he'll learn.
Are there any questions on preemption that you'd like me to address?
Yeah, I mean, you've done a really great job. I mean, this, and we appreciate the argument above counsel, but I think we need to figure out what we're going to do with it at this point. So thank you. Ben, do you have more for them?
May I have a minute or two for rebuttal?
30 seconds.
All right. Defense counsel repeatedly told you that the test was, did the defect manifest itself during the warranty period? That's not the test. Those words do not appear in the statute anywhere. If you read the statute, the words in the statute make clear that manifestation isn't a relevant consideration at all. It just isn't. The definition.
Well, you're right. That doesn't appear in the statute.
The definition of implied warranty, by its nature, includes defects that don't manifest themselves. Nexia is a new decision, but it is not new law. It recognizes that this was the law all along because it's the plain language of the statute. And the Clemens case was an express warranty case. In the Clemens case, this court, the Ninth Circuit, said no latent defect for an express warranty. But that's because of the language in the express warranty. It promises to repair defects in materials and workmanship that manifest themselves during a certain period. The implied warranty is a completely different animal. It uses completely different language. And finally, I wanted to address one point, which is the express warranty claim. The express warranty claim that we tried and lost on required more than just proof of breach of an express warranty. It required us to prove that a reasonable number of attempts were made and failed, and that the manufacturer did not offer to repurchase it. And so the jury's findings on that claim, finding that we did not prevail, do not necessarily mean the jury didn't find a breach of express warranty. They may simply have concluded that we didn't make enough repair attempts. Or they may have concluded that Toyota did offer to repurchase the vehicle. Obviously, we don't know what was going on in their heads, but it does not follow, the no answer does not follow the jury found no breach of the express warranty. They could have just as easily have found something else. And I just want to emphasize this point.
Well, was such an argument made to them? Certainly. If you don't find there's an express warranty, that doesn't protect you.
No, the argument that was made was that the defects were not sufficient to cause a buyback because they also have to substantially impair the use value and safety. That cause of action has a lot of elements. Breach of the warranty is only one of them. It is reasonable to assume that the jury rejected the claim because it found that there weren't a reasonable number of attempts or that the defects didn't substantially impair the use value or safety of the vehicle. The one last thing I want to address is this argument that this creates an unlimited warranty. If you accept our argument, it creates an unlimited warranty. And that is simply not true. And that's because the manufacturer always has the ability and the expertise to come in and show what the cause of the defect was. They could always come in and say, look, this part failed because of this cause. And then the jury would have to weigh. They would have to decide, do we believe the manufacturer's evidence that there's some other cause? Or do we believe the common sense rational inference that these types of things don't happen in the absence of a defect during the warranty period? It is simply untrue to say that if you accept the inference that the warranty runs forever. If you accept the inference, what happens is the manufacturer has to come in and show, no, it was something else. And remember, they have the resources to do whatever they want, to take the case to the Ninth Circuit, to have their dealers find out what the cause is. They could have done it here. They could have had their dealer come in and say, look, this is why this part failed. And it wasn't because of a defect. They could have done that. They could have done it very easily. But they didn't. Instead, they argued, well, it's not that big of a deal. It doesn't substantially impair use value and safety. We didn't have enough reasonable attempts.
No, what I think counsel was worried about was that people come in, as you said, two or three or four years later and say, well, if it hadn't been defect, it wouldn't have broken down so that it was manifested 2 years later. And that would just put them at risk for long, long periods of time.
But it wouldn't, because it would be very easy for them to come back and say...
No, I know, but they're talking about litigation and attorney's fees and costs and all that.
And there's one final point. I agree with that, but again, it's very easy for them to come back and rebut that inference. All they have to do is submit evidence from their dealers...
Yeah, but look, you said 30 seconds. you gave me a warranty.
I breached it.
You sure have.
Can I address the Senator song letter, or am I out?
Are you going to give us the lyrics to it, or what?
No, the letter from Senator Song, the legislative history.
Okay, go ahead.
All right. Thank you very much, Your Honor. I appreciate it. The letter from Senator Song was not approved by the California Supreme Court. In a case called Gabaldon versus Daimler Chrysler, which opposing counsel and I both argued before the California Supreme Court, the California Supreme Court did cite to that letter, but not on this issue, not on anything related to this issue. It was a completely different issue. It was an issue where the Song-Beverly Act had an ambiguity. The because we don't look to legislative history unless there's an ambiguity in the statute.
Yeah, well, you already gave it. You've given us the same reason four times.
Well, here there is no ambiguity.
Yeah, okay, that's...
So that's all I wanted to say. Right. Thank you so much, Your Honor.
All right, thanks for the workout. We're going to recess until 9:30 tomorrow morning.
All rise. This court is adjourned until 9:30.